Yeah, well, I met her first as a single man, and I just really liked the young people, the music, the way people were living. And it just seemed, everyone seemed full of joy and to be and happy. I mean, there was people suffering there as well. I remember seeing lots of people that were in wheelchairs and that at the first gathering I went to. But people seemed happy no matter what their life was. They seemed full of joy.
So it's a sort of a celebratory kind of organisation.
Yeah, and yet it's very much rooted on the earth and in normal everyday living as well. So it's not separated from what we all go through. We all are part of families. We live with jobs. We're under pressure, under stress. And yet we're able to, I think, see God in all this as well.
And Kara Lubick, who would have been the founder, I guess one of the main motivator behind the Focolare, there has been a call to make moves towards her step towards beatification.
Yes, on last Tuesday in near Rome, in Frascati, in the cathedral, the calls for her beatification and sainthood officially began in the church. And so she's on the road. She's now a servant of God officially. The title Servant of God, the next title would be Blessed and then hopefully Saint.
And what would that mean for the Focolare?
Well, it's a cause of great joy for us all to see our founder recognised so early, because she died about 5 years ago, and to see her on the road to sainthood already is a great cause of joy and recognition, I suppose.
It is quite early, isn't it? I mean, she's quite a recent person, and even people within the Focolare would have memories of having met her.
Oh, yes. Most of us would have met her. She came to Ireland, in fact, just a few years ago and stayed in County Kildare in Curry Hill's house and spoke to big gatherings and small gatherings. She met in UCD, I think it was about 1,000 people went to hear her, and she met the government, the president, Mary McAleese met her, received an Orison of Tyrone. The Bishop's Conference received her. Yes, she's a well-known personality in the church and was here just a few years ago.
And what was so special about her? I mean, you know, there is a lot of orders out there and there's a lot of different organisations out there. So why did she feel the need to set up a new one, and what was her vision and her mission?
Yeah, and I suppose to begin with, she didn't actually feel a need to set up an organisation. In fact, she didn't set out. She never thought when she was a young woman, and when she decided to consecrate her life to God, she never thought she'd have followers, that she'd have millions of people who followed her. She never set out to set up a movement or to be different than anyone else, but I suppose she felt called by God to live in a certain way with a group of people, and people were attracted to that, and it grew and grew.
And what was it that they were attracted to? I suppose I'm trying to get to the point, get to the heart of what was her mission. You know, when you think of the Franciscans have the idea of poverty, or the Jesuits finding God in all things, what was her sort of specific mission?
Yeah, well, again, if you want to put one word on it, the word we use is unity, to bring unity. And it was around the time of the Second World War when she and her companions started to live like this. And during the bombings in Trent, they used to go down to the air raid shelters with the gospel, and they'd read passages from the gospel. But one line particularly stood out for them, and that was from St. John's Gospel, the phrase, "May they all be one," when Jesus prayed on Holy Thursday, "May they all be one." And that phrase really gave them great joy, and they felt they were born so that they could bring this oneness, this unity to the world.
It must have struck a chord at a time when there was great disunity, in the sense, I mean, if you're in the middle of a war zone, the idea of unity would resonate with you.
Yes, and if that was Jesus' last prayer, that all may be one, surely it's worth living for. Because they saw everything else disappearing, you know, they saw their dreams disappearing in the bombs, maybe a boyfriend, one of them was engaged to a boy and he was killed in the war, and their studies were disrupted, and a lot of their ideals seemed to disappear, and they thought, well, only one thing really lasts, and that's God and the love of God. And if he wants us to try and build a unity and fraternity around the world, let's do it.
So that would have been, you know, back in World War II, a group of women, it would have been, I suppose, before the time that women would have lived independently as such. Did people wonder what they were about or what they were doing?
Yeah, it's amazing, because not only were they women, they were young women, you know, they were only in their 20s, and some of them were actually teenagers. And they started living in this way, and after a few years they had quite a few followers around the Trent area. I think up to 500 people used to come and listen to her every Saturday as she spoke to people. And then they felt, you know, that they were invited to speak in other places in Rome and other parts of Italy. And yes, people did get a bit suspicious of them because here were these group of young women going around full of the joy of the gospel and telling people how the gospel is real, how we can put it into practice, not just something to be listened to, but something we can live, and we can live in this fraternity together. And the church even was suspicious of them and was very slow to recognize it as a work of God.
And how did they continue, I suppose? How did they manage to sustain themselves?
Yeah, well, they always felt and knew they were inspired by the Holy Spirit and that it was something God wanted them to do. And they got some support in the church locally. The local bishop in Trent was supportive, but the church itself was slow, maybe because they were women, maybe because they were young. But they were slow to recognize. And this was a period of great suffering for Chiara and for her companions.
And was she never tempted to just break away when she wasn't being recognised?
She was felt very loyal to the church because she believed too the church was founded by Jesus. So if Jesus was asking her to one thing and the church was asking her not to speak in a certain place or a certain time, she was always loyal to the bishops and to the hierarchy of the church. So she never broke away, and even when things were tough, she stayed praying and living a good life and stayed living in fraternity together, in a sense of unity together and with other people.
Yeah. And when, I suppose, did the moment come that people went, actually they are onto something, maybe we should start to recognise them and support them?
Yeah, because this was before the Second Vatican Council. When the Second Vatican Council happened, I suppose, what came out in the early days of the Second Vatican and all through was very similar to what the Focolari were living, the people in the Focolari were living anyway. And so people began to see what these young girls are saying is also possible and is also true. And so they became recognised, and they were recognised by the church and were given an official title. Actually, Focolari isn't the church's title. They were officially called by the church, the Work of Mary is what we're called. But we were known as the Focolari as kind of a pet name.
Okay. And where did that come out of?
Yeah, well, it's an Italian name for fireside. And so people, when they met the Focolari, they felt like they were sitting by the fireside and they felt the light of the gospel, I suppose, and all of that energizing them. And they felt at home. And so they started calling it Focolari, which means hearth or fartinton, we'd say in Irish, I suppose. So that was their nickname in Italy. And so it has stuck and were known as Focolari. But officially in church circles, were known as the Work of Mary.
And in terms of the Focolari's own work, what are you going to do to try to help move the cause along?
Yeah, well, the Focolari aren't moving it. I think it's the local bishop of Frascati who is promoting the cause. But the Focolari will help because there's now the next stage is there's a tribunal appointed now, and they'll interview people, hundreds of people from the Focolari, to get to know what was Chiara Lubich like, and they'll study her writings and her videos that she made and all the, when she was speaking to people, the videos that were made of her speaking. So they'll study all these documents and see, is she worth raising to the next level, which is blessed.
She must be the first candidate for whom there's videos.
Yeah, maybe, I don't know that, but yeah, because
one of the first, anyway, sure.
Yeah, because there's lots in the Focolari, we've lots of videos of her speaking, and so they'll all be examined, I'm sure, as well. Yes.
And what about Pope Francis? What does has he been supportive, or what does he think of it?
Yeah, well, she had died just before he became Pope, but on Tuesday, when during the service, when they were starting the cause for beatification and sanctity, Pope Francis sent a message. It was a surprise. People weren't expecting a message. And he said that he described Chiara Lubich as a person who's luminous and exemplary. And he wrote how she welcomed the invitation of the Lord and enkindled a new light for the church on the journey towards unity. And so we in the Focolari then, it was a great joy for us. And you take great heart from what Pope Francis says. And so we're committed also, like Chiara, to spreading that new light that he spoke, that Pope Francis spoke about. That we're committed to spreading that new light that was Chiara's gift to the church and to all humanity.